Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. Jacob Birch, Eric Steven, mailbag episode, sort of-ish, of sorts, as you put it. I think just a very busy but uneventful week. There's stuff to talk about, to be sure. But the Dodgers, as opposed to winning a bunch and losing a bunch and then winning a bunch, have kind of middle ground here?
Yeah, they're kind of righted the ship somewhat. They're in that, like, you know, we always say we forgot how long the season is sometimes. They're in that sort of point, like, they're getting along. They're doing what they're supposed to do right now, I think. I don't even have it in the notes because it happened this morning. We're recording on a Thursday. Phil Bickford got a save today. Because the game ended in the eighth inning after rain, and so he pitched the bottom of the seventh, and they were ahead. So he, in a weird way, like the top of the eighth inning when the Dodgers tacked on a run and were still batting, counted. So Phil Bickford technically didn't finish the game. I mean, like he wasn't on the mound to finish the game, but he still got a save because why not? So yeah, that's the kind of weird stuff. Like there's no real bucket to put all this stuff into, so we're just gonna, it's kind of a,
yeah, that's a good way of saying it. Is like we've got stuff to talk about, but not one thing was so eventful or encompassing to really call it anything else. So we're gonna just wrap all the little things up. Dodgers rewind, questions from Craig, all of that after this. To start with, I think we'll start with the sort of controversy going around baseball, which has been a thing for a while, and a primary target of it, Trevor Bauer, called it out a few years ago, asking for it to be enforced, and now it's largely assumed to be one of the biggest winners of the situation. But baseball, in true to form, way late trying to enforce its own rules.
Well, it's like when people start getting loud about stuff, they're like, oh yeah, we have to fix this. This is terrible. Like, you know, when it's been going on forever, and like, but yeah. So I was thinking about this. So this is a catch-all episode because we have so many different things to talk about. So maybe we're just gonna try a bunch of stuff and see what sticks.
Yep.
No. All right. So just an overview to sort of set the scene. In March, MLB Club sent a memo to MLB sent a memo to all the clubs, saying it would randomly test baseballs, like pulling it out of games, like just at different times. They'd also like research. I just thought the way it was worded, I think, was funny. It was like, we're also going to look at like Baseball Savant and see if your spin rate went up. Basically, was the gist of it. And like, the problem is like there's chain of command stuff when you do that. Like, but anyway, they were just trying to get a baseline to see what was going on. And like there wasn't really like a threat, or I guess it was like an implied threat. I think the MLB sort of thought the memo was going to be like enough of a warning to like curb this. But you know, it wasn't. No major leaguer has been punished. The thing is, there's actually rules on the books for this, like, and for years. If a player is caught like doctoring the baseball with anything, including foreign substance, it's 10-game suspension. So, four minor leaguers got popped a couple weeks back, and excuse me, but no one in Major League Baseball has. The only like thing that sort of put this in the forefront was like the last week or so of May. Giovanni Gallegos on the Cardinals, he had like a bunch of white stuff on his cap. So Joe West, being Joe West, went out and had him change his cap. Mike Schilt went nuts, the Cardinals manager, and got ejected. And then after the game, went on this rant, which was kind of awesome. He said he basically was calling out MLB. He's like, look, if you want to start doing this, it's baseball's dirty little secret. Like, that's the thing, right? Like, it's sort of been for years, no manager's going to call out another team for doing that because they have, like, you know, a bunch of pitchers on their own side doing the same stuff. So it's just a matter of how far do you want this to go. But I think that's how MLB, like, oh, they'll police themselves, that kind of stuff. And then, but it's gotten to the point where it's so out of hand. I'm going to skip my like order here just to explain it. Brittany Giroli in, or it's Giroli, I guess, in The Athletic, had a good column sort of outlining why MLB is mostly to blame here, because the players are taking the brunt of this now, like Bauer and Garrett Cole. I'll get to that in a second. But so she noted the players don't get a say in the constant tinkering up to the baseball, which MLB has done the last few years, including this year. The new baseball this year has like raised seams, makes it like more susceptible to spin, especially if you're like doing stuff to it. So this is back to her article. The latest version of the baseball was already being buzzed about for its ability to favor pitchers with movement. Add to that last year's long layoff, which many believe triggered even more sticky stuff innovation, and it's little wonder why April was an historically bad offensive month. So the other thing she noted in there that like several teams, I don't know if the Dodgers are in this. I didn't look at their org chart, but she noted that several teams actually employ chemists, you know, like which is, you know, tells you sort of how this has gone. But anyway, so that's sort of where MLB is at this point. So now everyone's like looking at like any time like someone's spin rate is down in a start, people will share the screenshot of Baseball Savant on Twitter, and it becomes a thing. It was particularly stark on Sunday in Atlanta when Trevor Bauer, like, spin rate, like, generally for a fastball, like, if you're, like, 3,000, that's, like, otherworldly almost. Most of them are around, like, in the range from, I don't know, 2,000 to, like, 27, 2,800 or something like that. I'm not sure of the exact range, but Trevor Bauer's was down 223 revolutions per minute from normal on Sunday from this season. So of course everyone asked him about it after the game, and he's like, oh, it was hot and sticky in Atlanta, you know, that kind of stuff. But he was also like sort of went on his what he's talked about for years, like he said, I just want to compete on a fair playing field. I'll say it again, that's been the point this entire time, that everyone can be on a fair playing field. So if you're going to enforce it, and if you're not, then stop sweeping it under the rug, which is what they've done for 4 years now. So, to Bauer's point, another thing he's brought up I looked at some of his, like, old videos. You know, in March, he sort of went over the memo, and one of his points was, like, a chain of command thing, like, if they take a baseball out of the game, right, to look at it. Now,
chain of evidence, right?
Right, exactly. I'm sorry. So let's say a pitcher throws a ball and gets a strikeout. He gets the ball back, but it gets thrown around the infield, and then the ball gets taken out of the game, and that's the ball they test. Who's to say that the ball didn't get like marked, scuffed, something while it touched the third baseman, the second baseman, the shortstop, or like, you know, whatever. Like, so there's like this weird plausible deniability that, like, you know, it's just hard to like prove it that way. So you really have to like catch someone. But I don't know what's going to happen here. The other thing was Bauer was asked directly on Sunday if he uses foreign substances on the baseball, and he said he basically dodged it. He said, I made a lot of public statements. You know, you could look it up. So I did, and I had already done this, you know, that was sort of what I was writing about. He called out the Astros, specifically Garrett Cole in 2018, which sort of came up again this week. But in an article in the Players Tribune in February 2020, Bauer said, for 8 years, I've been trying to figure out how to increase the spin on my fastball because I had identified it way back then as such a massive advantage. I knew that if I could learn to increase it through training and technique, it would be huge. But 8 years later, I haven't found any other way except using foreign substances. So, in 2019, Bauer's fastball, his four-seamer, had an RPM average of 2410. Then last year, when he won the Cy Young, 2779. So, like literally right after he said, the only way I found you can increase your spin rate is by using foreign substances. Then obviously parlayed that into a Cy Young and $102 million contract with the Dodgers, and he's the highest paid player in baseball this year and next. So like you see what like where this sort of goes, right? But the other thing is, Eno Saris has written a lot about this in The Athletic. The everybody's using line is like true to a point, but I think there's degrees. Like the sort of classic go-to for a long time was sunscreen and rosin, which I guess technically isn't illegal because it has a nice mix. A lot of pitchers use it literally just for grip, but it makes the ball move too. But Eno Saris found like this sort of readily available substance that's become popular was spider tack. And the best part about this is you can buy it off Amazon, and the picture on Amazon shows a guy with spider tack on his hand, just putting his hand on a cinder block and holding it up just by lifting his hand, which is hilarious. And so that stuff increases in a study Saris did. I think it increased fastball RPM by like 500, like, which is nuts. And so like, that's a thing. The Angels, like former clubhouse manager, got fired last year. And then he sued Major League Baseball, and in the lawsuit named pitchers and like including evidence of like a text message from Gerrit Cole saying, "Hey, it's me, Gerrit Cole. Do you have the stuff?" You know, like or something like that. I don't remember the exact quote. It wasn't quite Paul Oduka saying thanks for the steroids on Dodger Stadium stationery, but like that level of that. So that's why Gerrit Cole was in it. And then like this week, Josh Donaldson called out Gerrit Cole, and he said he's been keeping books on pitchers for years. Gerrit Cole was asked the other day if he's used stuff. He had the most awkward answer I've ever seen. He's like, and then it was like seemingly 5 or 6 seconds, and then he finally answered it, and then he didn't answer it. And then he was saying about, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's passed down in this game, and it was like the most non-answer answer ever, but it was hilarious. And then he went out and like just beat the crap out of the Twins, and like his spin rate was like normal, and he was still throwing hard. So, it, you know, that's the thing, like, it does affect stuff, right? But like Cole's still good. He's going to be still good, like even if he's not. But I think MLB's at a point where they have to start like doing something. Like you have to start like punishing the heavy stuff and like get a hold of this. But I mean, we've seen this MLB with like what steroids, sign stealing. They don't act until they have to, and then they try to sweep it under the rug. So. They'll let the players sort of sit, stew, and take the blame. So I don't know. But the thing is, there's rules on the books for this. I think that's what they just sort of need to do to enforce it. And that's sort of where we're at right now. But, like, that's kind of where we're at. I mean, who knows what's going to happen. I guess another reason this came up was owners' meetings were last week. So they were sort of talking about the next step, and they said that the next sort of thing is how we're going to start enforcing this, and they're planning to, but we'll see how that goes. Like it seems like Bauer specifically and some other players aren't confident that MLB will do it properly or do it to a point where it matters, and it's just like more of a PR show than anything. So and also factor that in with this is also the final year of a collective bargaining agreement, so like neither side trusts each other. So it's going to be kind of a shit show at this point. So yeah, that's where we're at with the sticky stuff. But yeah.
Well, not news per se, but upcoming is the trade deadline. I think we're right, you know, mid-June, right when we really sort of aggressively start thinking about that, talking about that, as and really comes with some teams may become more convinced of their selling nature than others. So it's more likely that you're actually going to be able to acquire someone. Fabian Castaneda on Twitter asked, most seasons the Dodgers are usually able to buy at the deadline without trading away their top prospects. The farm system isn't as stacked as it has been in recent years. Do you think they have enough second-tier prospects to acquire players for the postseason push?
So I was looking at this. I went through and listed like every midseason trade. I'm not going to like recount that here. But since our Andrew Friedman took over in the Dodgers front office before the 2015 season, so they've had 7 trade deadlines. Now, last year, they didn't trade any prospects. They actually just traded Ross Stripling. It was a very weird year for a lot of reasons. But the other six trade deadlines, they traded a total of 34 minor leaguers. They traded some major leaguers, too. But, like, for these purposes, I'm using players who hadn't reached the majors. I'm also counting Frankie Montas as a minor leaguer, even though he pitched like 15 innings with the White Sox before he became a Dodger and then was traded, only because he still counted as a rookie and a prospect, and he was a highly rated prospect. So for this, I'm counting it. So 34 minor leaguers traded in a lot of trades in midseason. Now, this is not the same as offseason trade when the market is different. Like, the Mookie Betts trade is not in here, other things like that. But we're talking about like a trade deadline type deal. June or July or into August. There's no more August deals, but 14 of those 34 reached the majors, which is like a good amount. I always have a problem with people trying to say like, oh, we won the trade or who won the trade. Like,
right.
I don't always think it works like that because teams are at different points, but also like both teams should also be able to get something out of a trade. That's sort of the whole point of it. So to think that you're going to trade like busts all the time for Hall of Famers or something is faulty. Not that people are doing that. I'm just sort of throwing that as a caveat. But yeah, so 14 of the 34 reached the majors. However, of the 34 that were traded, only four were top 100 prospects in Major League Baseball that year or before the trade. Yusniel Diaz, who was in the Machado trade, Willie Calhoun, who went for Yu Darvish, Grant Holmes, who was in the Rich Hill Josh Reddick trade, and Frankie Montas, who was in that same trade. Now, if you want to count Hector Oliveira, which is fine, that makes five. But he wasn't in top 100 list because the Dodgers had just signed him in May and then gave him $62.5 million and like $28 million signing bonus and then traded him 2 months later. And like it turned out to be very prescient because he was like terrible at baseball and also a terrible dude, literally a criminal. And so they dumped him, but that's five. Well, just for sake of, you know, argument, that's five top 100 prospects. Now, Jarrell Cotton reached the top 100 the next year, like after the trade, but he wasn't top 100 when he was traded. If you even count players who reach top 100 in later years, like more than a year after the trade, you have O'Neill Cruz, who was in the Tony Watson deal, and then I might be mixing that up, but yeah, so then Yordan Alvarez is the other one. Now, obviously, Yordan Alvarez is like has been the best player they've traded away, like in performance since then, but he was also like very young at the time, and like 2 years away from reaching a top 100 list. So like that's like a long way, but even counting all that, that's eight players. So eight top 100s. Now, so I would argue that the Dodgers have done most of their work by trading these second tier prospects. That was sort of the point I was getting at. And like this year, the top 100s they have are Keibert Ruiz and Josiah Gray and then Michael Bush. Essentially, Michael Bush, I think, missed one top 100 list. And then they have a bunch of guys who like, I think Miguel Vargas is top 100 on one list. There's someone I'm missing who was top 100 on another. I forgot, but like they don't have a ton. So I think they're going to basically make their moves by doing these second tier top guys. Now, if something becomes available and they like, I think they would consider moving, Ruiz more than Gray, I think. But like, yeah, like, that's like their MO. That's the moves they've made, is like trading these like a gaggle of second tier guys. And they have like a lot, like I think Kyle Glazer at Baseball America looked at their farm system and said they have like, I think it was like 34 future major leaguers in the minors this coming into the year, which is an absurd amount. And like, you know, there's value like in those lower people, especially if you package a bunch of them.
Yeah, so, if like, anything, this may be a good, like, things may be lining up, whereas other years, like, oh gosh, we really need someone to replace Corey Seager. We, you know, and we want a starting level all-star level, which they got in Machado. And when you look at this team this year, they could really use another bat off the bench, I think. They could really use kind of the middle part of the bullpen could use some bulking up, I think. You could argue maybe another back-end arm, but I think it's Trinan and Kenley have looked pretty good. And Knebel may come back and provide that as well. So they shouldn't need those bigger splashy deals. Like you said, I think they would if they need it, but they shouldn't need it, hopefully. I think they have those second-tier pieces. Maybe you could argue even third-tier pieces to pull those kind of deals off.
Yeah, and I think the next question sort of gets into that, like sort of what you were talking about.
Not from this is from Blue John. Not too early for deadline talk. In addition to a reliever or two, what else may we see from Friedman? A more potent bat than Beatty to platoon with Pollock? Maybe a surprise starting pitcher to bump Gonsolin to the pen now that and Urias there for the postseason?
Yeah, so I'm still gonna half jokingly, half realistically lobby for David Fries to come out of retirement, because I think he remains like the kind of sort of bopper they need off the bench. I mean, Pujols is doing a nice impression of that occasionally against lefties, but they could use more. Like, literally, they only have 12 position players right now. When Corey Seager's back, they're, you know, obviously in a better spot, but like they had Yoshi Tsugo active, and he's on the IL. But I don't think he lasts past when Seager gets back. So they could use another bench player for sure.
I think the biggest concern is if anybody else gets hurt. We saw like the mm-hmm. depth thereafter in terms of bench roles is really, really rough.
Yeah. Yeah, so like I think any number, like, and it really almost sort of it depends on. I'm sure a multi-position guy would be great, because just the way they do stuff. But like, yeah, anyone who can sort of hit, I think they would be amenable to get. But yeah, same thing, like bullpen too. But honestly, like I almost think they should acquire a starter, like, because they got Tony Gonsolin back, and look, he only pitched an inning and two thirds in his first start. He walked five. That's why he threw 66 pitches to get five outs. It was brutal. That said, he's not going to do that. He's a good pitcher, right? Like, relatively, even if they do have a short leash on him, he's going to last deeper into games, so he's going to be fine. But you're still at a point where they don't have anyone behind him right now, because they need Nelson and Price in the bullpen, and also they don't want to stretch those guys. So Josiah Gray, still shoulder impingement, not really sure of his timetable. Like, he's the six right now, but he's not available. So, like, you still need – and this isn't, like – I'm not saying necessarily they have to go and, like, trade for Max Scherzer, right, who's going to be a free agent, and like, bump everyone down in the rotation or whatever. It's like sometimes you just need a guy to fill innings. And, like, there's a lot of season left. And, like, counting on all five guys to be healthy the whole way is rough, is a rough ask. So, like, getting a serviceable person who could either start or fill a swingman role or make Gonsolin the swingman or just have another guy available to start games, that would be preferable. If someone becomes available that you would start in a playoff game, I don't think they're, like, right now, like, you know, they would just start their four main starters right now in the playoffs. So even with, like, Urias' success in the bullpen, he's been very good as a starter, and so I think that's where it's at right now. Now, obviously, if they did acquire Max Scherzer, maybe you rethink that come October. But yeah, I don't know. I think they're open. They're open for business. But like, I think a lot of things could happen between now and July 31st. Like, Corey Seager's sort of plan right now, they're mostly healthy on offense except for Seager, and he's starting. He's almost about to do two hand swinging, and he's probably before the All-Star break now, which would be 2 months if he's All-Star break. So he's going a little bit faster than normal, but like, he's still like 3-ish weeks away. So yeah, and like a lot can happen between now and then. So who knows? But yeah, that's sort of where we're at. I have to admit, I did sort of cherry pick some of these questions we had. I did a locker room app thing earlier today, and I was going to answer questions there. Some of them didn't fit here, and plus all the stuff we were talking about, I thought we could sort of hit that. So I sort of limited it to trade deadline. Another person asked, like, which relievers might they get? I didn't have time to, like, sift through. So hopefully I can get to that on a future episode or when the trade deadline's closer, but just know I did see the question, and thanks for sending it. And if you have any other questions, you could send them to tblapodcast@gmail.com or to either Jacob or I on Twitter, Eric Stephen, ericstephen, or Jacob Birch, gacobburch. And G-A-C-O-B. There you go. What did I say?
G-A-C-O-B. J-A-C-O-B.
You're not Jacob Birch. Just pretend I know what I'm talking about. And you know what?
I do every week.
Send it to Gacka Birch on Twitter and see who responds. Yeah.
So you have a trivia question. I cannot figure out why you're asking me this, but I bet maybe it gets spoiled later.
It does. It doesn't get spoiled later, but it gets very tangentially referred to later.
All right.
But before I do that, there is no Gacka Birch on Twitter, so I'm going to open that and then answer this guy's reply. No. So there have been 13 total Dodger seasons of 20 homers and 20 steals by 8 different players. How many of the 8 can you name?
I will see what that number is after this. There have been 2020 seasons by 8 different players. How many can I name? Mm-hmm. Give me an over under. Give me something on the hip.
2, 3. I think you'll get 4.
Oof. All right. For the sake of our listeners, to the point where I'm just naming random 60s Dodgers, I'm just going to stop. But I have a list.
Wait, do you want a hint? Okay, go ahead.
I'll start. You give me a hint. Yeah. I may pass on the hint, and we'll go from there. Matt Kemp.
Matt Kemp was the last two to do it. 2011, 2009.
Raul Mondesi
did 3 years, and he was the first 30-30 player.
Rafael Furcal.
Furcal never did it because he never hit 30 home runs.
30? I thought it was 20.
Also, it never hit 20.
Okay. That's what I was about to say.
Yeah, you're right.
Right.
yeah.
Duke Snider?
Duke Snider did not do it. There was only one, I'll give you a hint, there's only one Brooklyn player who did it, and it was before that.
That's Zach Wheat?
No. Okay. No. Not too many home runs.
Didn't think so. Davey Lopes.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm cheating a little bit here.
That's fine. And I'll get to his season. He was actually the first 25-25 guy in 1979, career high 28 home runs, and he stole 44.
Oh man. So I've got,
he was the third Dodger with 2020.
Okay. Jackie.
Nope.
That surprises me, but now I'm done. I hit the under. Sorry, I did so well last week. I had to disappoint you this week.
That's okay. The other hint I was going to give was the Raul Mondesi thing was it's sort of the next player who did it is linked to him because they were traded for each other. Sean Green did it twice.
Definitely should have gotten him. Don't think of him as a Stony Stolen Base case, but I know he did on those first couple of years.
With the Blue Jays, I forget exactly which year it was, but he had 35-35. And then he was more homer-friendly. Homer-reliant centric? With the Dodgers. Yeah, exactly. Homer-centric is better. Did that wrong. The one before Mondesi directly was Kirk Gibson, 1988, 25 homers and 31 steals. Pedro Guerrero, back-to-back 82 and 83, 30, 20 years, 32-22, then 32-23. The LA Dodger before Davey Lopes was Willie Davis, 1962, 21-32. And then the Brooklyn Dodger was Babe Herman, 21-21.
your nemesis should have gone there.
Yeah. Now, so looking at this, if you go 30-30, it's only Mondesi twice and Matt Kemp. If it's 25-25, it's Lopes, Gibson, Mondesi, Kemp.
Jackie had 2 years with more than 20 stolen bases and 19 home runs.
Ah, just missed.
All right, I should have known Sean Green. I should have guessed Babe Herman because you gave me the time era in your hints. But other than that, I'm okay.
I have a in our notes. Luckily I have a bunch of tabs open, and I had the original search for this open because I didn't put the right link in the notes. And when I opened the link, it was the 2000 strikeout question from last week, and I was like, that doesn't. None of these players had 20 home runs and 20 steals, so I got very worried for a second there. But luckily, it was open in a different window. So okay, yeah. So the Dodgers rewind. That you very unscrupulously cheated on. No, I'm kidding. It's fine.
I think maybe, I would have guessed him no matter what, but exactly. I can't say that for sure.
So the lead-in is to Davey Lopes, who had the 28-44 year. This is one of the better ones. And, I mean, look, luckily we don't have to do a Dodgers rewind on someone who just died. So it's more of a celebration while they're still alive. It's great. And try to find obscure guys, but sometimes you got to play the hits, right? Like, and so we're going Davey Lopes this week. Was obviously a much ballyhooed member of the infield, 8.5 years together. He was part of the Dodgers 1968 draft haul, where they drafted roughly 737 players. That was back when they had like multiple drafts. He was drafted in the January secondary phase draft, which, whatever, like that's a weird thing. It was second round. He played a lot of outfield before that, and then they moved him to second because that's sort of what the Dodgers did back then. Bill Russell was also an outfielder, and then they moved him to shortstop. 1973 was the year the infield came together. Russell started the year at shortstop. Then Ron Say, six games into the year, sort of became the third baseman. Then Lopes in game 17 sort of took over every day at second base. And then it took until June till Steve Garvey wrestled first base away. So it was like the second game of a doubleheader in 1973 in June, when the first game that all four started at the various infield positions. And then they were together for 8.5 years, which is unprecedented for all four to be together. Now, Lopes, was incredible, right? Like, he was, I would say, prototypical, I think, leadoff man, especially for his era. From 1973 to 1980, so his first eight full seasons, he played part of the year in 72 as well, but not a full year. So his first eight full major league seasons, he was a bit of an older rookie, but still. He averaged 90 runs, 72 walks, and 49 steals. Now, 90 runs, it might not sound like a lot, but, it's also the 1970s. Like, scoring wasn't kind of nutso like it got at times. During that time, those 8 years, he led the majors in steals. He led the majors in steals in 75 with 77. He led the NL in 1976 with 63 steals. During those 8 years, he was fifth in in MLB in runs scored. The four ahead of him, Pete Rose, Mike Schmidt, Joe Morgan, and Rod Carew. That's awesome. Awesome company to be in. He was 15th in walks. So, like, not at the top, but, like, close enough to the top. So he was formidable. The other thing, he was excellent at stealing bases. He was not only prolific, he was like a genius. Later, when he became a coach, like the Phillies and Dodgers specifically, when he was first base coach, like he would teach base running, and those teams were excellent at like knowing when to steal, the times to steal. Like the technique and like their percentages were awesome. Like they always seemed to improve when Davey Lopes became the coach. So back in his career, he stole 83% rate in his 16-year career. The same with the Dodgers. I'll get to that in a second. He has 418 steals with the Dodgers. That's second in franchise history. Maury Wills had 490. He was eventually traded to, the A's in after the 81 season. He was the first of the infield to go. And then he played, bounced around a little bit, played for the Cubs and then the Astros. In 1985, he stole, before Davey Lopes, no 40-year-old had ever stolen 30 bases in a season. And then in 1985, he went and stole 47 bases when he turned 40. So, like, I just remember this because 1986 Tops, they had usually the first few cards, or, like, there was a 5 to 8 cards that were, like, record breaker of the year before. And I remember that it was, like, most steals by a 40-year-old or something, and I just thought that was crazy, that number. Since Davey Lopes, the only person to steal 30 bases at age 40 is Rickey Henderson, which you can sort of understand. Rickey stole 37 at age 40 and then 36 the next year. Rickey, he's awesome. Lopes was a four-time All-Star, 1978 to 81. I would say this is a technical term. He didn't take any shit from anyone, like both as a player and as a coach and a manager. But he was the team captain with the Dodgers from 1978 until he gave it up mid-season because like the Dodgers were going through some crap and like it was just like a bad year all around. Even though that was the year like Lopes had his 28 home runs, 44 steals, it was kind of crazy. I was reading Jason Turbo's book, They Bled Blue, a couple months back, and it was about the 1981 Dodgers. And during the strike, Steve Garvey filed a notice of default because he had language in his contract saying that he would continue to get paid no matter what. And so, like, Davey Lopes called him out on it. This is from Jason Turbo's book. We all voted to strike. Now, what does his vote even mean? You know, like, and then there was like this big kerfuffle over it, like, and they made up, but like, it was like a big thing back in 1981 because tensions were running high. He was fiery as a manager with the Brewers in 2000, from 2000 to 2002, and like, I think it sort of wore on him a little bit, but he also coached before he was manager, he coached with the Orioles and the Padres. After he was a manager, he coached with the Nationals, Phillies, and Dodgers. He went to the Nationals after the Dodgers, too. Not sure exactly what he's doing now, but I have another trivia question for you. Directly Davey Lopes related this time. 83.1% is what Davey Lopes, that was his stolen base rate with the Dodgers. That's third in franchise history for anyone who tried at least 50 times to steal a base. Who are the two people ahead of him?
So I have written down four names. We're going to go. We're going to see. And then I'm tapping out. No hints.
Okay. Yep.
Maury Wills.
Maury Wills is not one. And I'm looking. Because he ranks. He's 20th.
Okay.
74.1%.
Yeah, it's one of these things. Like, rate stat on stolen base percentage is so rough just because you don't necessarily want to take the volume guys. But whatever. I'm going to push on. Willie Davis.
Willie Davis is near the Maury Wills line. He's 18th, 74.3%.
Pedro Guerrero.
Oh, God. Hold on. He's actually 34th. Wow.
Okay.
67.2. Not bad. Yeah, 86 steals, 42 caught steals.
This is demoralizing.
I'll give right. You want me to give you a hint?
One hint. I better not help.
They were Dodgers within the last 4 decades.
All right, the last name written down, I'm looking at now because I assume I'm wrong, was Mr. Juan Pierre. I'm getting you your number right now.
He was 11th.
Okay.
77.5.
I'll take it. I give up. I'm tapping out. Screw this question.
Before I give you the top two, I will tell you that Dave Roberts is fourth, 82.5%. Kirk Gibson is second, 88.5%. Eric Davis, let's see, what was he at? 52 steals, 6 caught stealings in his 2 seasons with the Dodgers, 89.7%.
All right, here on out, I'm just going to say Davis, and you're just going to give it to me. Every single time it's...
Willie, Tommy, Eric, yeah.
No, wasn't there another one that popped up a few weeks ago? I'm going to look this up.
I think it was Tommy.
No, it wasn't. I'm looking this up. Otis Davis.
That's right, Otis Davis. Ron Davis was also a pitcher, but okay. Yeah, we'll see.
All right. Hey, hilarious. You know what I need to pick up the mood, pick up my spirits?
To embarrass me in trivia questions?
Yeah, that's part of...
With Jeans and Craig. We love them.
The first of 5 questions from our friend Craig. Our trivia.
He says there's 5, but there's like.
There's, it's first really. It's
always
like
a 97 parter. Yeah, exactly. I'm not complaining. It's just. It's fun.
He's complaining. Let's see. The Dodgers just played their 60th game. So this week we'll focus on sustained hot starts. Name these LA Dodger leaders. In the first 60 games. The first 60-game hot starter. 4 players have scored 50 or more runs in that span. Can you name them?
Okay, so this is when the Dodgers are in L.A. Okay, so speaking of old friends, let's say Tommy Davis.
Nope.
Maury Wills.
Yep.
Number
2 with 54 in his 1962 season.
Brett Butler?
Nope.
Liar. Matt Kemp?
Nope.
Gary Sheffield?
Nope.
This is rough.
If you rewind to earlier this episode, you'll get one.
Oh, Davey Lopes?
Yep. Number 1, yeah. 56 in 1979.
I actually meant to guess him, and I
no, didn't. Sure.
I had so much Lopes on the brain. let's see. Wow. Let's see who. Sean Green. Whatever.
nope. So your 2 missing seasons are 77 and 2019.
So Bellinger.
Yep, is 2019
for
77. With 50.
And Reggie Smith.
There, you got it. 1977. Mm-hmm. All right. 5 players have 45 or more walks at the 60-game mark. Who are these patient players?
Wait.
3 were teammates. That's your hint.
Muncy's 1?
Yep.
Yeah, he's like exactly at 45, I think. 3 were teammates. Oh, God. Let's see. That's a lot of walks. Holy crap. 3 words. I don't like you. nope. Jim Wynn.
That's one of the teammates, 1975, 47.
Okay. In that case, let's go Steve Garvey.
Nope.
Davey Lopes.
Yep. Really fun if you had bricked twice on our rewind subject. Also 75 with 46. To clarify one thing, the other teammate...
was a different year?
Yes. And excuse me, Jim Wynn's actually on this twice. I apologize. I didn't realize there was a repeat. It's still 5 players, but I have 6 seasons.
Am I missing 2?
You are missing 2.
Oh, okay. Okay. 70. Okay, so if it's 74 or 75, Steve Garvey not with the runs. I already got Davey Lopes. I don't.
So the season is 77. Clarify one thing.
Okay. So yeah. All right, that makes sense. Yep. Let's go back to the Reggie Smith train.
Nope.
Let's instead say, Dusty Baker.
Nope.
Ron Say.
Yep. So you're missing one season. It's 1960.
Oh. Frank Howard?
Mm-mm.
No, 1960. Sir. Jim Gilliam?
There you go.
Nice.
All right. Next part. Six players have averaged more than a strikeout per game as they struck out 61 times. Who went down swinging the most in the first 69 games of a season?
This is batters, right? It has to be.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Only one of them was after Kershaw debuted. That's your hint. Or hold on. Two of them? Ignore that hint. There's a word missing and I can't figure out what it is.
Okay. Strikeouts. Max Muncy?
No.
Bellinger?
No.
Jock Peterson?
There leads the pack with 74 in 2015.
Good God. Jose Hernandez? No, that was his. He struck out with the Brewers. I forgot. Okay. Chris Taylor?
Chris Taylor in 2018 with 66.
How are there six? Good Lord.
I think half is the word missing. Half were after Kate Kershaw debuted.
Oh, okay.
Of which you have two.
Yep. Karros?
Nope.
Man, I don't think Billy Ashley played enough.
You may want to think again.
Billy Ashley.
1995,
wow.
68.
Wow. that's stunning. Then who would have been? Sean Green?
I don't think. Nope. Yeah. There was also an answer I think earlier you should have committed to. And I was looking stuff up. Hold on.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to give you two more guesses.
Yep.
You have Jock Peterson, Billy Ashley, Chris Taylor. You're missing two other names. Those seasons are 1990 and 1985.
You said 85?
85 and 90.
Mike Marshall
is 85 with 61. So you're missing number 1990 with 73 strikeouts.
Cal Daniels?
Juan Samuel.
Ah, of course. Yeah.
Finally, six batters have grounded into 12 or more double plays in their first 60 games. One is Albert Pujols. Yeah. No. Who were those rally killers? Hint. Four played in the Jacob era, and they also it's evenly split, three righties, three lefties. I think you could qualify four of these as my era, and I'm counting Piazza as my era. Yes, it was before I paid super close attention, but I knew who Mike Piazza was. So,
Karros?
No.
All right. Jeff Kent?
Nope.
Adrian Gonzalez?
That's a good guess. I wonder how that's his record.
Man, double play. I am just not like registering who hits into double plays for some reason. You know what? I'm tapping out.
James Loney hit 13. The rest are all 12. Mike Piazza, Andre Ethier, Dusty Baker, Mike Marshall, and Sean Green.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
There you are. Next That's question. Right. Next question. Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. I did bad too. We can just console each other. Will Fernando Tatis and or Ronald Acuña Jr. get to the 30-30 level this season? And will Shohei Ohtani be able to do something like 30-20 in 2021?
Okay. So I put them in the notes here. So Tatis currently has 17 homers and 13 steals. He's actually one off the homer lead and tied for the stolen base lead, which is ridiculous. Acuña's right there too, 18-11. I don't think either one will get 30-30, just because I think they're going to fall short on steals. Tatis might get to 30, but I don't think so.
I think Tatis will. I'll go down on record.
All right. No for me. Yes for Acuña, no for Tatis?
Yes for Tatis.
Oh, so yes, you're doing... Wait, no for Acuña.
Correct.
Sorry. All right. And then Ohtani, he's at 17-9 at the moment.
I want to know. I really wanted Shohei Ohtani to be a Dodger.
Yep. I wrote this too. So he also has 60 strikeouts as a pitcher. He's pitching tomorrow. His ERA plus right now is 162. His OPS plus is 155. just a ridiculous player. Like, so good. 17-9 is like right on that edge. You know,
I feel like he won't get there in stolen bases, but wouldn't shock me.
So you're going to say no. I'm going to just be the optimist here and
sure.
say yes.
I appreciate that. I'm rooting for him for sure.
Oh, but this is the germ of how I came up with the earlier 2020 thing, because Chris Taylor is sort of the most power speed guy on the Dodgers this year. He has 8-6 on a pace for 21 home runs and 16 steals. So that's what got me thinking about 2020 years.
There's not a lot of specific schoolwork I recall from elementary school, but I do remember a creative writing assignment we had where I wrote from the perspective of the sand underneath a famous statue in Egypt.
That's wow.
Weird.
Yeah.
Do you two recall any assignments or projects from elementary or middle school?
A couple come to mind. Sixth grade English, Mr. Gregory. A guy who I believe a couple years later got into trouble because a substitute showed porn in his class I think it was an accident. Who knows? But anyway.
Jeez.
Yeah. I forget what the exact assignment was. It had to do with like medieval times or writing a story. So I wrote about Eddie Murray as this might have been seventh grade English. I forget the years. But Eddie Murray as like a knight and or something. And like the whole thing. But my favorite part of the story, I remember putting this joke in, was that I referred to Sir Paul of La Habra. Referencing the local TV ads or the TV salesman.
Now, did any puns make it into the story?
You know what? Like, it was all like, it was inspired by the old, like, Looney Tunes where I think Bugs Bunny had cirrhosis of liver, you know, that kind of thing. And so I had a bunch of those type of jokes, but I honestly, other than Sir Paul of La Habra, I don't remember exactly like what it was, but yeah, there was that. The other thing, one of those years I had a computer class in middle school, and this is like the early days of computers, and this was this had to be seventh grade, because I made the computer program, and all it was, it just spit out what the Dodgers first half and second half stats were. And literally, it was just average home runs and RBIs, because that was all that mattered. And
it does matter.
The program was just like make it do something. So that's all it was like, you know, you enter like first or second half, and then it showed you like every player, and like that was the thing. So I'm not saying I invented baseball reference, but no, just kidding. Yeah, but it was.
The suit's coming down.
Yeah, exactly. No. So that kind of thing. Yeah, those are the ones that sort of stand out.
Only one that comes to mind for me, and if I thought longer, I'm sure I would think of some, but I was absent. I think I was on vacation when my fifth grade class, I think, did like this snail assignment where like you picked a snail and you had to like describe it and like observe it over time. I forget exactly. I wasn't there, so I could only base it off what I was told. But so I was given free rein to observe something else and write a report, scientific report on it. So free I rein. Observed a friend of mine who was constantly getting in trouble in class and observed his movements throughout the classroom based on his disruptive behavior. I think I got an A on it.
Yeah, for being a narc. No, I'm just kidding.
But not really.
I forgot what. Yeah, exactly. Narc. I forgot another thing I did was this was also I think seventh grade. I did a rap about Johnny Tremaine, which just absolutely brought the house down. It was me and my friend Josh, and I want to say this was the time I had my like bright yellow Lakers starter jacket, which was like one of the most prized possessions I've ever had. So I was really playing the part, and I'm sure a video exists. I'd be mortified, but yeah, I just remember it felt awesome at the time. But yeah, good times.
Max Muncy has a 12 home run lead over Cody Bellinger for the contest. Who will hit more home runs from now, prior to game 61, until the end of the season, and can Bellinger hit more than 25 home runs this season?
Okay, so I put in notes, in 2018 when Muncy came up, Muncy hit more than Bellinger that year, 35-24. Bellinger won MVP the next year. He went 47-35, and then they both hit 12 last year. So it's kind of even, right? But between now and the end of the year, I'm actually taking Muncy.
So am I. I think he's just so locked in this year, and any time you come off a lawn injury like Bellinger does, it can just take a little bit to get back in sync. And we've kind of seen that now. He certainly looks better than the alternative options, but I think it's still going to take him a little bit of time to get there. And with the dead end ball, who knows how Bellinger will kind of really react to that outside of his would-be home run that we saw.
Right.
We've seen that, and we've seen the grand slam. So, but neither towering home runs, I would say. So I'm going with Max as well. So no contest.
I do think Bellinger's getting to 25, though.
So oh, interesting. Yes. Okay. I don't. How about that?
All right.
Summertime reminds me of Jell-O desserts my mom and aunt used to make. One was a three-layer dessert, strawberry Jell-O with fruit with a sour cream layer in between.
Oh,
another was cookie crust cream cheese. That sounds good. Cream cheese, yeah. That sounds good. Lemon Jell-O layer.
Oh, okay.
Topped with lime Jell-O. And now...
Wait a second. Cookie crust, cream cheese, and lemon Jell-O.
Yeah, man.
Topped with lime Jell-O. What the hell is going on? No, there's a lot of weird, like Jell-O-y type stuff that is just awful.
And now... I'll finish the question. And now I can't think of the last time I had Jell-O. So, did you have anything like those that you two can recall? And has Jacob's daughter had Jell-O yet? In vitro, she has in utero. Oh. Excuse me. Via
she
Melissa.
To Nirvana?
Yeah, no. Melissa ate Jell-O while she was pregnant, but not since the birth. So, and I haven't had Jell-O in a tremendously long time. It was probably before high school. Like maybe
wow.
I had it sometime in high school. I don't like Jell-O, man. It's gross.
So the last, I'm sure I've had Jell-O in the last year. I'm certain of it. But like not the powder, make it myself. I don't need that extra step. It's occasionally like getting the cups and like sugar free or something, because it's like a decent like snack every now and then, and like so that's about the extent of it. The one like sort of jello-y dish I can remember, my sister forever always would make pretzel jello, and it was essentially like strawberries and like inside strawberry jello, and then like a layer of I guess whipped cream and then pretzels at the bottom, and it's good. It's really, and it's like, it's a nice little dessert to have, and we've had that a lot over the last 40 years or whatever. But yeah, like it's been a while since I've actually had that, but that was a thing that was like just always sort of a thing. I think the older like jello-y type desserts were like in the 80s and maybe early 90s and stuff, but like I think we sort of went away from that at family stuff after a while. Maybe it was like my grandma not being around anymore. I'm trying to think. I don't think my mom made a ton of that stuff later. I just can't remember it. But yeah, so I'm not sure the last time I had any of those weird stuff. I usually stayed away from that stuff anyway, other than pretzel jello, which was really good.
I think this might be the only time I walk away not super hungry after the last question.
You're not going to go out and do jello shots? Yeah.
Well, I am, but that's for...
Well, obviously.
Reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well... All right, everybody. That means our podcast is over. The refrigerator door's closing. The butter's getting hard, and the jello is jiggling.
Yep.
We'll see you next week, everybody. RIP Chicken.